Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today has devoted his professional life to better understanding one of the most complex, polarizing, brilliant, yet deeply flawed political leaders of the 20th century, Richard Milhouse Nixon. Luke Nichter is an associate professor of history at Texas A&M Central Texas, a former founding executive producer of C-SPAN's American History TV, and a noted expert on the Nixon tapes. He's developed a website, nixontapes.org, which offers free access to the 3,000 hours of tapes that are publicly released. He's also been an active litigant in unsealing the rest of the Nixon tapes, as well as testimony and records related to the Watergate investigation. Nichter, along with historian Douglas Brinkley, are the co-editors of the Nixon tapes, 1971 to 1972. A follow-up volume of the tapes from 1973 will be published next year, as well as his own history, Richard Nixon and Europe, the Reshaping of the Postwar Atlantic World. Nichter will be a guest of the University of Tulsa's Oklahoma Center for the Humanities and Booksmart Tulsa tomorrow evening. He'll be appearing tomorrow evening at 7 o'clock, and he joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Luke Nichter, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me on.
You've been very much involved in the release of the Nixon presidential tapes and this new book. You decided to focus mainly on his foreign policy achievements, which probably if Watergate hadn't occurred, this is what we would remember Richard Nixon for, isn't it?
I think so. You know, I mean, there was a lot of domestic policy, too, that really still to this day hasn't gotten a lot of attention, the creation of the EPA and Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, and a bunch of other things. But, you know, focusing on 1971 and 72, Watergate didn't become a big national story until 1973. Nixon wanted to keep the lid on the scandal through the 72 election in November, and he was able to pull that off. So here in 71 and 72, we see him focusing a lot of his time on opening relations with China, negotiations with Russia, the Vietnam War, and a lot of other foreign policy issues.
And why that focus for the book?
Well, we had to make decisions, this book is, as big as it is, something like 753 pages, it started much larger. And the daunting task that we were faced with, me and my co-author, Doug Brinkley, was that when we started this book, there's only about 5 to 7% of the tapes have ever been transcribed or published. And so the other 95% have not. And the 5 to 7% we have are primarily on really kind of Watergate scandals and the more sinister aspects of Nixon. But these 5% have basically created almost 100% of the impression we have about Nixon, his presidency, and kind of who he was. So what we tried to do in 71 and 72 is we had to make decisions. Let's focus on what Richard Nixon focused most of his time on. And he being a foreign policy person, that's what he did well. He delegated domestic policy. But he thought a president had to run foreign policy. You couldn't delegate that to a presidential assistant. So we tried to focus on what Nixon himself spent most of his time on.
And as you know, when you look at an 800-page book and you see that these are transcribed conversations, I think the tendency is to think this is the record, but this is probably what percentage of what was taped in the White House.
Well, that's the thing. We tried to make this book as and the hard thing is you're dealing with audio. So when you have a printed book, it's really sort of a two-dimensional rendering in some ways of a three-dimensional object when you have audio. And, that 5 to 7% I talked about when we started this book, even with this big book, I would say we've pushed the needle maybe to 10 to 12% of the Nixon tapes have now been transcribed or published. And with the sequel volume we're doing on the 73 tapes that'll come out next year, because Nixon tape in 71, 72, and 73, we'll push the percentage a few points higher on the scale, but there's still an awful lot of work left to do, and for many other people besides just me.
Now, the book gets underway on February 16th, 1971, with Alexander Butterfield, who will be the man who actually discloses the fact that this taping system exists when the Watergate investigation is heating up. And he's you use this very first conversation. It's a conversation in the White House. He's explaining how the taping system works.
He is. And the quality is terrible. This is one of the ones that's in the executive office building. And it really shows you, I'm very proud to say this book has the fewest number of unclears and unintelligibles of any book about the Nixon tapes. So let's use the Nixon tapes in any way. But this is one of the really terrible ones. I think they haven't quite fine-tuned the system yet. And Alexander Butterfield is explaining to Richard Nixon how the system works. You don't have to push any buttons. It's sound activated. Nixon was not the first president to record. Presidents all the way back to FDR had recorded starting in 1940. But what Nixon did that was different than all the rest before him, and we assume no one has taped since Nixon, because I think presidents have learned the lesson that Nixon learned, is that Nixon's taping system was sound activated. When he stepped into a room that was one of the locations that was taped, whether the cabinet room, the Oval Office, the Executive Office Building, Camp David, a number of phones across the places he spent most of his time, the system automatically turned on at the sound of noise. So sometimes it's Richard Nixon who makes that noise. Sometimes it's a cleaning crew or a tour group. There's all kinds of interesting things that were accidentally picked up besides sort of serious policy moments. And so we start in the beginning of our book with the beginning of the taping system. Seems like a logical place to start.
Now, one of the interesting things that you realize pretty quickly as you're reading through this text, and it probably makes the transcriber's tasks far more difficult, Nixon was a very, how do I say it, active listener. He loved to finish people's sentences. I think there are times when he's listening intently, but if they're not getting to the point very quickly, he's finishing their sentences. It's hard to read, as a matter of fact, at times, because the thrust of the conversation is so juxtaposed between the two individuals. As he's finishing sentences, anticipating what the guy's going to say and interrupting whoever he's speaking to in the Oval Office, it's hard to catch the thrust of conversations at times.
It is. And Nixon, the way I like to think about this, and you're really onto something here, you know, Nixon, I think I go back to his legal training, went to law school at Duke Law School. You see Nixon as president in the Oval Office, he's much like a prosecutor, cross-examining a witness on the stand. And he's interrupting, he's interjecting, he's finishing sentences, he's finishing thoughts, he's inserting words that might be spoken but haven't been spoken. And this is one of the hard things about a transcript, when I say rendering a sort of three-dimensional object in two dimensions, is that the trouble with a transcript is you can have a transcript that's completely accurate, but it doesn't give you, the reader, emphasis. It doesn't give you the cadence of one speech. It doesn't give you the emphasis as one speaks. And so you're really missing that. And one of the things, you know, this book came out of my work on my website, nixontapes.org, which is a free public service to the world, where I have digitized all of the tapes from reel-to-reel and cassette forms and made them available. So the book means a lot more when you have a chance to listen with the audio simultaneously, kind of side-by-side, because there are some conversations that are hard to follow. Nixon is very complicated. It's not one speaker speaks and another speaker speaks, and they take turns, and it's very clean back and forth. Nixon is cross-examining many times those in the room, and it is hard to follow sometimes.
One of the things I found most interesting about this book was, you know, Nixon set up this taping system basically so that he wouldn't be subject to the recollections of others. He would have an authentic record of what was discussed in the Oval Office, and he was thinking about this pretty early in his first term, it seems like. And you get the sense that whatever conversations it's about, whether it's peace negotiations in North Vietnam or ongoing talks with the Russian emissaries, Gromyko and the ambassador to the United States, he's thinking about how this, whatever happens, is going to play, how it's going to be reported. He's very concerned about his image, almost to a sort of a low self-esteem sort of manner.
It is. And there's not a clean answer. You know, the first question I often get is, why in the world, you know, if these tapes were Nixon's downfall, why in the world did he make them in the first place? And it's a complicated answer. You know, I think Nixon knew that he wasn't the first to tape. I think he thought he was going to go into retirement into San Clemente, California, and have them to write his memoirs. I think he thought a little bit like Churchill. He thought in grandiose terms, especially about himself, that he, like Churchill writing his multi-volume memoir of World War II, that Nixon would be able to retire and write his multi-volume memoir about Vietnam and China and the affairs of the world that went on while he was president. And, of course, that turned out very differently. But one of the things I always try to draw attention to, especially to younger audiences, you know, today the law is very different. If President Obama sends a text message today to some assistant, according to the Presidential Records Act, which was passed after Nixon was president as a result of Watergate, that's a public record. And one day we have the right to view that and inspect that record in the National Archives, probably decades from now. when Nixon was president, the law was very different. There was a much larger gray area, a much larger space for discretion of a leader, what was public, what was private. I think a pure cynic would say every time a politician opens their mouth, it must be public. There's some political angle to it. But a president does have a private life. They're also a father. They're also a husband. They're also a brother, et cetera. So in Nixon's time, the law was that he had the full expectation of leaving the White House, not the way he thought he ended up leaving the White House, but that these tapes would remain his private property forever. Nixon never expected a book like this to be written, and it was only possible because Congress effectively subpoenaed the tapes in a criminal investigation.
Now, one of the few Watergate conversations that is in the book alludes to that thing you were discussing earlier. Nixon felt like he had been wiretapped at times, or that was sort of the policy of presidents going back. And he was talking about the bugging of a Democratic national headquarters. He says, why do we have our people sweeping our rooms before I come into it? It's because I'm afraid that it's going to be bugged. It was sort of like a tit for tat thing.
It was. And, you know, a famous book came out in 1973 by Arthur Schlesinger Jr. called The Imperial Presidency, referring to the Nixon administration. And I there's a lot of truth to the argument in the book. But what's clear, though, when you listen to a sufficient sample size of the tapes, beyond the soundbite, beyond the drip, drip, drip that have come out over the years in various films or documentaries, what you see is that the imperial presidency had been building for decades. It had been contributed to by both Republicans and Democrats. And I think Nixon, in many ways, felt that he was just doing things that his predecessors in the White House had done. Now, in some ways, he did take them too far. But, you know, take, for example, the 18-and-a-half-minute gap conversation just a few days after the Watergate break-in. This is the famous erasure that Rosemary Woods erased on the tape. And I wish I could say we had we had recovered the erased portion for this book. But to give you a point, a lot of people investigate that, and they only listen to just what's before the erasure and just what's after the erasure. And when you listen, it's about a 90-minute conversation. When you listen about 45 minutes later, you have Nixon saying to Bob Haldeman, his chief of staff, now, if the phrase is now, back in connection with wiretapping. Well, there's no portion of that conversation that deals with wiretapping, unless it's part of the erased portion, which no one's recovered. Mm. And so I think it's the first book not only to suggest that that's one of the reasons for the erasure, if they were talking about wiretapping policy, but I think the Nixon tapes also suggest to us that there's more to Watergate than we've been led to believe, that it had a lot more to do with wiretapping, the intelligence community was much more involved. And we're going to get into that more in the 1973 sequel that comes out next year.
Now, as we read through the conversations, it's not surprising because we knew that Nixon and Kissinger were close. But how much of the discussions in regard to foreign policy didn't necessarily include the Secretary of State, didn't necessarily include the Secretary of Defense? It was Henry Kissinger, who was at that time the National Security Advisor, and Nixon and Bob Haldeman, the chief of staff. That seemed to be the triumvirate, and really Nixon and Kissinger, but Haldeman to maybe a lesser degree, really doing stuff that we would expect a cabinet secretary to do. I think nowadays, cabinet secretaries, we don't think of them, but in those days, we still thought of them as helping craft policy with the president.
Yeah, and I think what you see is Nixon's mode of operation and the way that he created policy. I think there are similarities with some of the other presidents, but also differences. You know, today in more recent history, Secretary Clinton and Secretary Panetta have both written memoirs that suggest that they were cut out of some policymaking that went on in the Obama White House. So I think it's become a tradition in some ways that the president's always closer to his immediate staff in the White House than he is to these more distant cabinet secretaries who are really bureaucrats running large organizations that have become so large in the country's 200 years. But under Nixon, I think you're right. You know, up to that point, cabinet secretaries did have a larger role in policymaking. And I think Nixon really felt, especially in foreign policy, the president had to make foreign policy. You could not delegate that to anyone else. He consults with Secretary of State William Rogers. He consults with Secretary of Defense Mel Laird, but that they could not be the ones to actually formulate the policy. So I think that's the role that they're really reduced to. And you see this come to a head in this book when Nixon makes his famous trip to China in late February of 1972, where they have to bring the Secretary of State along, because how could you make such a visit without bringing your foreign policy advisor, the Secretary of State? But they really don't know what to do with Bill Rogers. He hadn't been involved in the opening of relations up to that point. He hadn't been on any of Kissinger's secret trips. He'd made no trips of his own. And most of the policy had already been worked out by the time that Nixon had gone at a lower level. So it was very awkward at times trying to make the Secretary of State feel included in the Nixon White House. But I think no one, everyone understood the Secretary of State didn't quite have a real role in policymaking.
It was also interesting just to hear Kissinger and Nixon, in some cases, kibitzing. I mean, it was kind of like kick up your heels talking discussions. They were talking policy, but they were also sort of relaxing at the same time. And, you see these sort of Nixon neuroses and paranoias of the intentions of what he would consider his enemies. You know, we understand why there's an enemies list, because the way he focuses on how people are assessing him, it's really quite fascinating.
Yeah, this book was surprising to me, I think, when we did it, because I think we expected a pretty consistently serious policy book, and there's plenty of that content in there. But there are also a lot of funny, lighthearted, unexpected moments in there, too. And you've got Nixon and Kissinger. Nixon constantly comparing himself to how JFK viewed himself, as the press treated him, viewed him, as the country viewed him. Nixon and Kissinger concerned about the sex life of Senator Ted Kennedy at various times. There are a number of joking moments. Kissinger coming back as he's advancing and planning Nixon's eventual trip to Moscow, the first president to go to Moscow in the spring of 72. And Kissinger comes back to report on all of the female companionship the Russian government offered to Kissinger at every leg of his journey. Because Kissinger was famous, he wanted the image of the ladies' man. And the Soviet leader suggested, well, try our ladies. They have more experience. And it's really awkward, funny moments you wouldn't have expected by Richard Nixon. So it was really a gratifying book that was fun to work on, because there were these moments that broke up a lot of the serious discussions, too.
There were also some dark sides of his personality. I mean, in one case, I can recall one conversation where he's talking about homosexuality. It was involved with a group that the presidency had been involved with that was endorsing a sort of relaxation of discrimination against homosexuals at the time. And, you know, his view, I thought, was sort of enlightened for a person of his age. But at another time, he's trying to exploit a thought of a leaker who may have been gay. So he was not against, using it against him when he was playing political hardball. There's also other conversations where, this degree of anti-Semitism comes into play. It was not a pretty picture. I mean, but again, these were private conversations, I suppose, and he thought he was, it's hard to believe that he authorized a taping system and would put those sorts of things on tape in 21st century cultural life.
Well, that's right. And those two examples are really good ones of really the complexity of the character Richard Nixon, because take anti-Semitism. There's a lot of material in here that we would definitely call anti-Semitic. Would we label Nixon an anti-Semite? In some ways, yes. In some ways, no. On the other hand, he had friends who, he didn't have a problem with Jews. He had a problem with liberal Jews, as he saw them, who didn't vote for him or support his politics. He was friends with Max Fisher and other conservative Jewish leaders. A number of his top aides, Henry Kissinger, Arthur Burns, Herb Stein, were all Jewish. He supported Israel, never says a bad thing about Israel. Israel supported him. Prime Minister Golda Meir credits Nixon with saving the state of Israel during the 1973 Yom Kippur War. So it's complicated, and it's what you see is the same thing with his views towards homosexuality. You know, on the one hand, Nixon says we shouldn't persecute them. He tells Bob Haldeman, who must be shaking his head because Nixon says it more than once, but we don't see the nonverbals in the audio conversation. Nixon says they're born that way. Leave them alone. We can't persecute them. So he has this very enlightened view, as you say, for someone of his time. I mean, as we're listening, this is in the early 1970s. The federal government still considers homosexuality a mental illness, a disorder. This is only a couple of years after Stonewall. So he has this very enlightened view on the one hand. This isn't even a major platform or position of the Republican Party today. On the other hand, he does want to investigate those that he thinks are homosexual. And he also makes a couple quips that, well, the downfall of strong civilizations is almost always
yes.
homosexuality. Look at the Greeks. Look at the Romans.
Yeah.
So the answer is it's complicated.
My guest today is Luke Nichter, Associate Professor of History at Texas A&M University Central Texas, a noted expert on the Nixon tapes. He and Doug Brinkley are the co-editors of the Nixon tapes, 1971 and 72, a 780-page book filled with conversations about the opening to China, the beginnings of detente and the Moscow summit in 1972, the peace negotiations with the North Vietnamese. Also, one piece of domestic policy you included was the conversations on August 15, 1971. And as your editing foreword of the conversation suggests, Nixon on that day, pretty much with John Connally and George Shultz, hammered out the linkage which removed the United States from the gold standard.
That's right. How could you find a conversation that changed the world, you know, more than that? I mean, up to that point, monetary policy had always been conducted a certain way. There'd always been a link between the U.S. dollar, almost always, and some kind of commodity, usually gold. And here you've got Nixon, who had almost no background in economics. You have Connally, who has no background in economics. Shultz is the true expert on the issue. And they're dealing with what ends up being not just a major domestic issue, but a major foreign policy issue. And there's not a single foreign policy advisor present during the conversation.
There's nobody from the Federal Reserve present.
Nobody from the Federal Reserve. The closest you have is Connally is the Secretary of the Treasury, but it's really his Undersecretary of Monetary Affairs, Paul Volcker, another name we recognize, mm-hmm. who would be the real expert on this. But this group, Shultz, Connally, and Nixon, are meeting because they're primarily concerned with the political aspects of the policy, and these are politicians. And Nixon is thinking about one thing primarily, and unfortunately it's not the economy. He's thinking about his election a year later, and he's thinking about what do I do, what are the consequences of what we might do here, because any time there's an economic change, even today, the reverberations of that can ripple for months later. And Nixon knew that by the time any change we make here, we're going to be into 1972. And we're in 72, we're already going to be in the heat of my reelection campaign. So they're thinking in this meeting primarily about the political impacts of this decision. But certainly this was a major economic decision, one of the greatest economic decisions made in the entire post-war period.
In fact, you said this begins the modern global trade relationship in the world.
Many experts have said this is really the beginning of the global economy because by untethering the dollar from gold, what we did is we removed restrictions on how much stocks and commodities could increase in value. What we also did is we removed safety nets of how far they could fall. And you saw a major global recession in 73 and 74, just a couple of years after this decision. And even in the most recent recession a few years ago, there were calls again by some politicians to return to some kind of gold standard, to reform the Fed, and to bring back some kind of stability that this free-for-all of the economy might not always be a good thing for us.
Now, one of the other interesting evolutions that you see in these 2 years is Nixon's view of how to conclude a peace with North Vietnam in the Vietnam War. The beginning of the book, we've got to win this thing. We have to win this thing. He looks at anti-war protesters. There's an interesting little thing about John Kerry and John O'Neill, who, again, was Swift Boats in the 2004 campaign. Those guys have been fighting together for 34 years.
That's right.
They were arguing back in 71. But you see this sort of evolution that we have to win this thing. Don't these anti-war protesters know we have to win it? They're trying to destroy the American government by protesting this and make us weak. He never really got that part of it, that people were protesting the war because they felt it wasn't a just war, it was not a right war, and it was not in America's best interest. But over the course of those 2 years, you see this evolution that we're going to conclude peace any way we can, and I'm going to give lip service to the fact that we think South Vietnam's safe, but he really get the sense that perhaps he really didn't truly believe that.
Well, that really does bookend the whole process very well, and there's even further kind of evolutions even between those two, the beginning and the end. And, you know, there are a number of academic theories and books that have tried to describe Nixon's philosophy, his strategy throughout the Vietnam War. And I think, again, when you listen to a sufficient sample size of the tapes, what you see is, I think it really humanizes Richard Nixon, and it makes you, I think, in a way, sympathetic a little bit with any wartime president, not just Richard Nixon. Richard Nixon's mood in a given moment about the war depends on how the war is going in that given moment. And on weeks where the casualty reports are high and things aren't going well, you hear him saying to Henry Kissinger, "We got to get out of this thing now. We got to get our POWs." That was about the only thing he consistently insisted on, was we got to get our POWs, as many MIAs as we can, and we got to get out of there. On other days, take after May 8, 1972, when he bombed Hanoi and mined Haiphong Harbor, he was feeling pretty good, and he was willing to go the distance on the war. So I think you really see Nixon oscillate back and forth, and in terms of any kind of grand strategy he might have had, and I'm not sure there was one on Vietnam, I think he wanted the best possible terms for the war, whatever that meant at the moment. I think he really wanted to get the POWs back. He eventually caved on a transition for South Vietnam and democratic elections. That's the thing he had to give on. So his position consistently evolved, depending on the news of the day and the news of the week and how things were going, not just in Vietnam, but how things were going in negotiations with China and Russia. Nobody wanted American forces out more of Southeast Asia than the nations who shared that continent, China and Russia. So I think Nixon also thought he could use the Vietnam War as a negotiating tool with China and Russia. Why pull out and give them something for free? They want us out. Let's get out in a way where we get something in return from them, too.
Interesting. You're petitioning the government in a federal court to unseal more of the Watergate-related government records, and you've been involved in, litigation to unseal a lot already. What is left that we can learn about Watergate from this litigation? I think you've alluded to the fact that you think there might be a new origin to the reason for the Watergate break-in in the first place.
Well, I mean, look, there's been hundreds or thousands of articles and books written about Watergate. I mean, you think, what else can there be? I mean, this certainly must be a topic left just to conspiracy theorists and things. But, you know, the truth is actually surprising. By that, I mean, Nixon recorded 3,700 hours of tapes, almost 4,000. To this date, more than 40 years ago, 700 to 800 hours of tapes, I mean, 700 to 800, have never been released by the government. And a number of these are going to deal with Watergate. They're going to deal with intelligence and wiretapping. And besides that, in terms of the record that I've been working to get out and unseal through the district court in Washington, there's an enormous amount about Watergate that has not been released. You've got the star witness testimony of, for example, Al Baldwin, the guy who actually did the wiretapping of the DNC. He overheard the wiretaps from the Howard Johnson Motel across the street. He was the star witness at the time in John Sirica's courtroom. His testimony is totally sealed on what he heard. We're not allowed to know what he heard. And so there's an enormous number of records like that. Plus, I think it's easy to say tens of thousands of pages of records from the time. The entire grand jury process of the summer of 72. I mean, the only time where everyone who was involved in Watergate was forced to testify in secrecy is sealed 100%, except one example. Nixon's grand jury testimony was unsealed in 1975, was unsealed in 2011, just a couple of years ago. So there is tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of pages about Watergate that still haven't been opened. I don't know that any of them are going to dramatically change our role of Nixon. After all, we have these tapes. We know what he said. We know his involvement in the cover-up. But I think what we're going to find out is these sealed records have been sealed in part to hide the activities of others. And I think when it comes to wiretapping policy, it's going to make Nixon look worse, but it's also going to make Kennedy look worse, Bobby Kennedy look worse, Lyndon Johnson look worse. There's a lot I think we have left to learn about Watergate. The version we know today by Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein, I wouldn't say is incorrect. I don't think they're wrong, but it's incomplete. And I think over the coming years, we're going to fill in a number of details.
Luke Nichter, we wish you great success with this ongoing project. Thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, thanks again for having me. My pleasure.
Nixon tapes expert Luke Nichter speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. He is the co-editor, along with historian Douglas Brinkley, of the Nixon tapes, 1971 to 1972. He'll be a guest of the University of Tulsa's Oklahoma Center for the Humanities and Book Smart Tulsa tomorrow evening at 7 o'clock, now at a new location, the University of Tulsa's Chapman Theater in Kendall Hall on the TU campus. The event gets underway tomorrow evening at 7 o'clock. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.